And you are listening to Radio Regent. This is not Saturday Morning Live. And Radio Regent, we used to be... This is Saturday Morning Live. This is Saturday Morning Live, but this is not CKLN. This is definitely Saturday Morning Live. But joining us on the line is L. Jones. And L. Jones is from Nova Scotia. She's a spoken word activist and teacher. And she was the two-time captain of the back-to-back national championship Halifax Slam team in 2007 and 2008. And she has performed all over Canada, including the 10th anniversary All-Star edition of When Sisters Speak in Toronto. And I was at that concert or that event, which was put on by Dwayne Morgan, who used to be with, he's done a lot of work with Saturday Morning Live. And joining me on the line is L. Jones. How are you?
I'm good. I'm sick, so if I start hacking disgustingly while I'm talking, I apologize.
Oh, that is no problem. Basically, we're trying to form some links with people in Halifax, Nova Scotia. We have had on Rocky Jones, and we've had on Carol Ann Wright Parks, and we know many people in Halifax. So we basically wanted to start a sort of a dialogue between Halifax and Toronto. We are in Canada, and Canada is so spread out. You know, there's not a lot of contact. There's no national black newspaper. So basically, we wanted to just begin a dialogue with Halifax, and your name kept on coming up. And what are you working on currently?
What am I working on currently?
Yes, ma'am.
I teach, and nobody knows about this, so I'm going to talk about it on the show. We actually have in this province the only all-black adult education program. It's called the African-Canadian Transition Program. It's at the community college, so I teach in that program. And it's actually amazing. We have all black faculty, all the office staff is black. Of course, all our students are black. Even if we get like a tutor for someone, they have to be black.
Is that in Dalhousie? Yeah, is it Dalhousie?
This is at, no, the Nova Scotia Community College.
Oh,
so we're
okay.
In our seventh year.
Okay, go ahead.
And we're graduating. I think 12 students are getting their grade 12 this year, and then we have about another 10 that are going on to finish their final year of high school. So that's exciting to me. You know, we have a lot of students that come to us through the criminal justice system, students that come off assistance and that make a decision to get their education. So we had a 72-year-old woman last year who decided she wanted her high school. We have everything from age 19 up to age 72, and we educate them in a black-focused manner. So we teach them their own history. It's all in a black classroom. We have our own classroom in the college with our own art, our own way of teaching, and we become a family for that year, and we just love our students and give them unconditional love and try to undo the trauma of the education system and work with them and get them to go where they want to go next. So that's the most rewarding thing I do. I also teach at the university, so at Acadia, and then still doing spoken word poetry. I work with, I volunteer with youth in the square, which is one of our housing areas. So the people from Africville actually moved into the square, so we have a music studio down there, and we work with the youth. And they come and record and write, and we mentor them in getting their art, but also just chilling with the youth and helping them feel good about themselves. So that's some of the stuff that we're up to.
I'm speaking with L. Jones. I basically I've always been interested in Halifax, Nova Scotia. I remember reading Stokely Speaks and Stokely Carmichael, a.k.a. Kwame Ture. And one of the things he said that he wanted to have tea with his, this is before South Africa was so-called independent. He wanted to have tea with his wife, then who was Mary McCabe in South Africa, and he wanted to go to Nova Scotia because Kwame always talked about Cape Town to Nova Scotia, you know, the whole unity of African people. And I basically wanted to know your history in terms of, you know, Nova Scotia is a spot where you had Africans who came from the United States and fought on the side of the British. Then you had a lot of people coming from Barbados, and then you had a lot of people, Maroons, that came there from Jamaica. The Jamaican government took them to Nova Scotia. So I basically wanted to get your what is your background in terms of where are your roots from, other than Africa? Once your folks came out of Africa, what is your background in terms of Nova Scotia?
Oh, well, I'm not like Scotian. I'm Scotian by way of Trinidad.
Ah.
So I'm a Caribbean, I guess, but interestingly enough, there were 5 Jones brothers in Scotia, and 3 of them went to Trinidad. So
now that's very interesting. I always thought that you were Scotian in terms of when I heard you speak at the at Wayne Morgan's slam, something just...
Well, I'm spiritually Scotian, but no, I'm not indigenous Nova Scotian. When I came to Nova Scotia, I came and I found my blackness. Like, whatever fit here, the way that I felt about myself and history and culture fit very much with the way people here think. So I think I've always embraced what Nova Scotia is. And to me, like, it's my chosen spiritual home because of how the people are here. Like, people, like, George Eliot Clarke talks about this. It's a different kind of blackness. So, I mean, we're all united in disaster. I don't mean to imply that, but when you come to Nova Scotia, the way that people feel about the history, the tightness of the communities, you know, you have a 400-year-old history of black people who know who they are and have been kept down specifically because they are some of the only self-liberated people. I mean, we're talking about people that came as Maroons, people that came as refugees, people that came as loyalists, people who freed themselves to get to Nova Scotia, which, as we know, is the most dangerous thing to white people, a black person who consciously freed themselves. And that's the people here. I mean, that's what the blood is. So you have these amazingly strong communities that just do not mess around and aren't interested in, you know, being made multicultural on someone's terms or, you know, giving up the history so they can integrate. People that know who their community is, know who their ancestors are, know where they stand, and have been just brutally crushed down, but all kinds of survival all over the place. So those are the people that just resonated with me. They took me in. You know, tough love some of the time. You know, like, people, a lot of people from away go, oh, you know, I can't handle it here. But, no, I mean, the most beautiful people. So I'm really blessed that... I'm glad you think I'm Scotian, because I wish I were. No, I don't. I never wish to be who you're not. But I'm just, what I found here, I think, is unlike anything else. And I think everyone should come and experience it.
That just proves my point. Even geniuses like myself make mistakes. So
I was actually going to do you a Nova Scotian history poem, but maybe now you think I'm fraudulent. I don't know.
No. The whole question of Nova Scotia is, when I think about Nova Scotia, I think about apartheid South Africa, and I think about Mississippi in terms of, you know, black people are really segregated in, from what I understand, Nova Scotia.
Yeah, people call this the Deep South of Canada,
right,
or
right.
The Mississippi of Canada.
Right.
And that's something that's known. I had somebody from Mississippi, a black person, message me on Facebook and be like, hey, what do they call Nova Scotia, the Mississippi of Canada? So, and the reason is that the intense, as you said, intense segregation. When people came here for festival, they were shocked that black people can't get cabs in Nova Scotia.
Right, right.
You cannot get a cab downtown. We had segregated schools here until 1983. I mean, officially they disbanded in the 60s, but the last segregated school closed in 1983. You know, we still have communities with no services. If you go to North Preston, which is, you know, 200-year-old community, they still don't have sidewalks. They don't have grocery stores. They only got bus service 5 years ago. So, I mean, we're talking about this level of systematic exclusion. People my age, their parents, they basically removed from school in, you know, grade 7, given SIN numbers and basically sent to work, you know. So people that were only sort of one generation into even being permitted to get a high school education. When you look at the history, like timelines of black history in Canada, you see so much Nova Scotia. The first race, what they call a race riot, what we would probably call an uprising, resistance, rebellion in Shelburne, right? So in North America, the first one took place in Nova Scotia. So this is the kind of history we're talking about and the systematic oppression that followed, knowing that this is the kind of people that were in this province. So, very ongoing today.
I'm speaking with L. Jones, a spoken word activist and a teacher. Now, Nova Scotia, I read Donna Summers' autobiography, and her one side of her family, their roots are from Nova Scotia. And I know that Duke Ellington, he had a wife from Nova Scotia. And, Nova Scotia, a lot of Nova Scotians have moved. There's a link between Nova Scotia, Boston, and so on and so forth. Could you talk about the current scene in Nova Scotia now? We know that L. Jones, we know about Shante Grant, we know about there's a great singer from, I think he's originally from the United States. Duke, who am I thinking about? He's an R&B singer, sounds very much like
Dutch Robinson.
Dutch Robinson. Could you give me an idea of, first of all, what is the spoken word scene like in Nova Scotia? Could you talk about some of the work that you've done? I know some of your stuff is on YouTube, but could you talk about the spoken word and then the other arts that takes place in Nova Scotia?
Yeah, well, spoken word, I mean, you mentioned Shante Grant, Rita Israel Jones. So those are people that have been working. David Woods, who was doing work before we were, Anne-Marie Woods. And then before that, obviously, a lot of the oral traditions, the griot traditions that were in this province. But I think one thing that Nova Scotia poetry has had for it, Scotian poetry has had for it, is that we've always been a concentrated black voice. So, I mean, we don't go to slam anymore, but when we went, it was like Scotian family. People came to us because they recognized that what you represent coming out of Scotia, coming out of Africa, so with those experiences, is a touchstone for other black Canadians. You know, that there's this historical weight, the weight of the ancestors does speak, and we've always been conscious that, I think spoken word artists, and before me, I mean, like, I came in and joined a scene that was already happening. So that kind of collective feeling of bringing the voices of the ancestors forth and speaking out of that. So we've always had conscious black poetry, and that's disappearing. I think something you see, and I think maybe it's more slam gets popularized, people try to be like the States. You're not seeing people getting up to the mic and just spitting, like, real political stuff out of their own experiences. You know, people are trying to do poetry more that maybe has become more mainstream, is more acceptable. So I don't think young black poets are as intensely sort of consciously black in their poetry as... I feel like I'm almost the last of the old school, like when I started, was almost the last kind of edge of that. But it's something that I think Nova Scotia has really kept going, because we know that when we go to speak to our youth, we're talking to youth that are in crisis. We're talking about youth. You know, we had one of my students, her 15-year-old son was shot by another 15-year-old boy over nothing, right? And this is what we're dealing with every day. So when you go to do a poem, are you going to, you know, say some nonsense about something that doesn't matter? Are you going to choose your words and make sure you're speaking to them about themselves and their history and who they are and where they come from and what the situation is, and explaining racism to them and trying to explain what the system is doing to them and giving them some way of dealing with that, right? So I think that's what the spoken word scene has traditionally been in Nova Scotia, and I think it's a tradition that we consciously try to engage with, that we really do try to keep a black-focused scene. When you get up on the mic, what are you representing? You know, knowing that, you know, my grandmother couldn't speak. You know, there's no way that she could have ever spoken what she thought. She wanted to be an opera singer. She was a black woman. There's no way she was going to be allowed. So when I
she wanted to be an opera singer?
I'm speaking for her. My grandmother.
No, but I'm saying that is, voice. That's a... I think that was Nina. There's a lot of our people that wanted to do classical music or opera, and yeah, I understand exactly what you're saying, right?
Yeah, you know, so I have the opportunity to be an artist, and it hasn't been an easy path. I mean, people have threatened to kill me, people have banned me from things, you know, people haven't liked what I said, but I can still say it. Nobody's actually going to kill me, I hope. And I know that my recent ancestors weren't allowed to speak, so when I get up and speak, am I going to talk about, you know, like, some beef I have with a random person, or am I going to try and speak about history or speak about what racism is or say something, some truth, something, right? And that's a responsibility that I think we hold and that we're trying to do in spoken word. I would say the biggest cultural export right now is the Big Perm. So if you're not up on that, but you know what I'm talking about.
Well, I don't.
So are big perm, it's the big Scotia dance that our youth came up with.
Oh, okay.
So if you look up Big Perm Crew on YouTube, you can see the Big Perm.
That's a dance?
It's a dance. And yeah, the youth in Toronto know all about it. When they came out here, some youth from the Y came to link with our youth, and that was the first thing they asked, if the youth could show them the perm. So that's our big culture act. But we got Jordan Crouch is doing it up in Toronto. I don't know if you know about him.
Who's that?
Jordan Croucher. He's like R&B.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There, you can have it all.
No, I'm laughing because I was heavily influenced by the most honorable Elijah Muhammad, and the whole dancing thing is like, I kind of have a strange position on dancing, so I don't keep up with. I'm not in the Nation of Islam. I'm not a follower of Elijah Muhammad. I'm more of a Malcolm X person, but I don't keep up with the dancing thing. But that's definitely, I'm in the minority. I accept the fact that our people, African people, dance. So I have a minority position, so I'm gonna look.
Our youth are doing it up. I mean, we have youth at the studio that are coming in every week and recording tracks, and you just see them. I mean, one problem in Nova Scotia is, of course, like a lot of people don't know that there's black rappers in Nova Scotia because it's all the white rappers that get funding. So you probably know Classified, Buck 65, and those are the people who get the video fat grants and get promoted. And we've had, you know, all kinds of rappers for ages, and you just never hear about them. So there's a strong rap scene here, and all kinds of people doing, you know, work that's never really heard. But so, you know, we have youth coming up all the time.
Well, I think that's why we need to keep this relationship. We need to talk to you three or four times a year, you know, or whenever you have some time, because I think we need to have a link between all of Canada in terms of Halifax, Toronto, Ottawa, Montreal, Regina, Vancouver, the whole country. We need to be united.
Yeah, we had Calmindy. I don't know if you know Calmindy Vibe Collective out of Montreal.
Yeah.
Yeah, so they came this year. We had them in February. And they did a workshop with the youth, and they had the youth playing instruments and everything, you know, like they did a 3-hour workshop. And so our youth got to get up that we used to being in the studio and sort of understanding hip hop culture and engage with this whole history of music. And, you know, like they're like, oh, I have to keep playing that loop. And, you know, Calvin's like, yes, you have the experience of making music live. You can't just put it on the computer. But it was amazing. And they got the youth playing instruments they'd never played in an hour or two. And, you know, them being able to come. And we had, you know, some young Rastafari children that, you know, they're the only ones in Nova Scotia, so feeling ashamed of their locks, and then community to come and be like, oh, sister princess, you know, and make them feel positive about themselves. So having those connections when we come into each other's spaces, and everybody just felt lifted, you know, for weeks, community and us, we were just like, oh, you know, but, and especially for a place like Nova Scotia that is so central, but in terms of history, but so much on the margins for Canada. Being able to, I think everyone needs to come here. You need to see Afriville. You need to go up into North Preston, because driving up into North Preston is like driving into the hills of Jamaica, and that's maroon blood, right? Like this is the people, the communities that people made, and you still hear the old people who have come up from the Carolinas. We have the Gullah people, Georgia. It's the same accent, the same African languages that are still being spoken in the way that people speak. So the North Preston accent is that same preserved African speech. And it's amazing, and people in Canada don't really know that exists, and to think that there's people that were literally left here to die. I mean, that's what the people here were. They were liberated people that were just dumped onto the worst land they could find, and they thought they'd die, and they stayed and built, and what they built in those communities, you have to experience.
And some went back to Sierra Leone, correct?
Yeah. Because yeah, the 1,200 loyalists went back, and also a bunch of the Maroons. Got kicked out. Well, Wentworth brought in the Maroons. And, of course, Maroons had fought the British for 200 years on and off. And then finally they made a deal with them to send them to Nova Scotia. And then Wentworth wanted to use them as the military troops. But the Maroons weren't really having anything out of that. So they built the hill, but they kept on getting in fights with everybody. But they were just protecting their culture, right? And that's the spirit that they had. And they just weren't happy here. And they were like, no, man, like, we are getting to Africa. And they did. They got themselves back to Africa. So there's a big connection in Sierra Leone when you go there. Sometimes people say they see Scotian faces, like you can see the ancestors and the same blood that's running through here. Nova Scotia, the land itself, used to be part of Africa, right? It's a broken off part of Africa. So,
well, let me ask you this. Pardon me, did I cut you off? Sorry if I did.
No, you didn't at all.
Now, the question is, how the youth of Nova Scotia today, how many, or what is the situation in terms of people learning to play instruments, and are there any vocal groups in Nova Scotia? Because, you know, now the computer seems to have taken over music, where you have people that, you know, like, where are the artists that can play all the instruments and sing all the parts? Is how strong?
Well,
how strong is Nova Scotia in terms of people learning instruments? And is there vocal groups out there? Because I think the industry has basically killed
Rainey
vocal
Smith.
Groups.
Rainey Smith is an amazing singer, instrumentalist. We have a strong gospel tradition here. Because you have to remember that the church is big in Nova Scotia. I mean, like 99% of Black Nova Scotians are Black Baptist.
Is it a Baptist church?
Yeah, the Baptist church. So, and there's a reason for that. Richard Preston, who's the founder of the African United Baptist Association, mm-hmm. and you see that you were using African, and we're talking about 1860. So, I mean, the fact that people in Nova Scotia were using African consciously in the way that Garvey was using it kind of gives you an idea of the mentality, right? But Richard Preston was an escaped slave from Virginia, and he came looking for his mother. When he came into Nova Scotia, he sort of knocked on the first door to go and find food or a place to rest, and his mother opened the door, and she recognized him because he had a scar on his face. And that place, people think Preston's named after him, but really he took his name, we think, from Preston. But he realized that the people needed something to unify them, because there had been a loyalist coming in the 1790s, and then you had the wave of the refugees in like 1812, from the War of 1812. And there was two groups, and the loyalists were a bit better off. They had more land. The refugees had come. They had been left with nothing. They were begging on the streets. So you had this kind of idea that the Black refugees were just, you know, homeless beggars. That's what they were being talked about like. And Richard Preston recognized that people needed something to make them into Nova Scotians. So he decided that he was going to use the African Baptist Church. So he walked on foot all across the province and unified people and created the African United Baptist Association. And so that's something that has run strong through the people. It's been where people have met. And we know the role of church as a religion. So, I mean, it can be conservative. It also has had this very revolutionary social justice intent. And that, so the church for a long time played that role, singing and playing in the church. We have a huge gospel tradition here. It's still, you know, you still have church bands when you go into the church, and there's all kinds of music. So you do have young people that are in that tradition. They still do the shake down in North Preston. You know, so those old African dances that you still see, those worship dances that people may not know where they come from, but they're still doing them. But we do have that tradition. But like you said, I mean, our young people, and deliberately so, I think, you know, they make every effort to cut them off from their history. So we have a huge music program in Nova Scotia in the schools, but you don't see Black kids in the orchestra. And, you know, like, we actually have, like, a Halifax orchestra, but, like, Black kids aren't going to be in there, right? So the opportunity to, play instruments and make music and get those kind of lessons aren't as available to them as they should be. And of course, they've been told that that's not their culture, so they don't know about jazz. You know, you mentioned even stuff from hip-hop 20 years ago, and they don't know, never mind knowing about jazz musicians, or, you know, that Beethoven was Black, or, you know, the idea that we have our own classical music, that we play these things. So, yeah, I mean, that's one reason why we brought Calmunity, because we wanted them to experience that and to know what it's like to play live, and that kind of connection with the music and the spiritual connection and what our African history is. So, as we know, our youth are having their identities taken away from them at every minute of every day. Nobody's telling them their history. They're telling them this nonsense about, you know, like, oh, we're multicultural now, it doesn't matter, you know. So it's always an effort that you have to make with youth to put that back into them and give them some guidance to where they come from and hope that they can learn from it. That's being taken away from them, I think.
Let me ask you two questions. We're running out of time, only because where we are broadcasting this, there's a drumming group that comes in, and they're gonna overpower us. And we have about 3 or 4 minutes, but I want to ask you two questions to close, or three questions to close. One,
okay.
How strong is calypso and soca in Halifax? One, two, could you talk about what you are currently doing? And three, is there anything else you would like to add?
All right, so Calypso, Soca, well, we have a lot of students that come in. So, I mean, one thing we need to work on in Scotia is the relationship between different groups of black people. It's not always as comfortable as it should be, and that's a class issue sometimes because you have a very working class black people and students coming in. You know, those connections are difficult, which we need to make. But those students, we have a lot of Caribbean students, so there are socials. They bring dance hall to us, but a lot of that happens on the campuses. So, yeah, like we get DJs, we get stuff in. As far as people making Calypso, I don't know, but hopefully this, I mean, Caribbean people would probably know more of that, but that goes with the Caribbean students. Number two was what? the second question.
Well, the second question was...
what am I working on?
Yeah, what are you doing currently?
Well, I'm still a part of Word is Bond Collective, so we're in our 13th year, so it's a poetry collective. It was founded in the Black Student Advising Center at Dalhousie, so we do monthly shows. We're the only grandfathered plantain, so it means we don't hold a monthly stand, so we can do open mics so that people feel encouraged to come. I don't know, I was working in the prisons for a while, so I'm still doing that. Like, I go up and do writing group with the men in prison. And you get the best poetry out of our brothers that are behind bars, right? Like, the kind of stuff people have to say there. So that's more, I think a lot of stuff what I'm interested in is this, you know, like, we can get up and speak, but finding the ways that other people can, you know, use poetry or use some way of voice to speak about what we're going through, and to, that is resistance against oppression. So I guess, to a certain extent, what I try to do is do a lot of that, like working with youth, working with our people in the communities, going into prisons. I go to the women's prison as well, and those women are, I think those are the most blessed experiences as a poet, when you can go and talk to people and relate to them just on the level of, I did a poem for you, and you felt it, and you're doing a poem for me, and I feel it, and it doesn't matter what else we are. So, I do my thing. I go around, I do poems.
The prisons.
Spoken word doesn't change.
When you talk about prisons, I just wanted to say, I don't want to cut you, but prisons, we produce Tookie Williams and George Jackson, Malcolm X, so you have some brilliant women and men inside the prisons. I understand that.
Yeah, and as we know, like, on purpose, we have brilliant people in prison, and New Harper has cut the chaplain, so for example, like, our Islamic brothers can't get any kind of religious chaplaincy in prison anymore, and they started that mostly to keep the black guys from meeting, right?
Is that, and when you talk about the religion inside the prisons in Nova Scotia?
Yeah, I don't know if you know this. No, in Canada, they cut all the other chaplaincies but Christian chaplains. So you're only allowed to have Christians. So they used to have, like, part-time chaplains from other faiths, and they just cut it. So every prison has a Christian chaplain, but, for example, there's no imams, and they're not allowed in. And they basically did that. They said it was funding, but, of course, why they did it is to stop our Muslim brothers and sisters. And as we know, black brothers go into prison, and a lot of them find Islam, and it empowers them, and they become Malcolm X. So it's to stop that. So,
well,
they're not allowed to meet.
I grew up in Los Angeles, and I know that the California prison system were the first people that forced the system to recognize Islam inside the penal system in California. Was the Nation of Islam. They don't call themselves imams, but they are imams. The Nation of Islam, Minister Malcolm, Minister Farrakhan, but they are theoretically imams, and that was done. Yes, I understand that. That's a very significant role, right?
Yeah, and so, I mean, they're claiming that the Christian chaplains can just do that role. And we know that in the Aboriginal brothers and sisters, they have some, I mean, they still have sweat lodges and stuff, but basically it was an attack on Islamic inmates being able to meet and being able to spread the kind of empowerment that we've seen. So when you go into the prisons, that's, you know, like, they're really trying to stop the black inmates from meeting, from having any kind of conversation, you know, and what the inmates tell you. And I don't even like using the word inmates, political prisoners, what they tell you about what's happening. They're just cutting stupid privileges, like they can't get cake mix or whatever, right? So a real attempt to just really break people down and make sure that nobody who's behind enemy lines, behind bars, has an opportunity to link with each other to get any kind of education. So they can't, a lot of them, they're cutting having courses. So it's very hard for them to get diplomas and take college courses and do all the things that we know our brothers and sisters have used their time behind bars to come out stronger. So they're always trying to cut that back. So it's really important for us to go in there and work our way in, however we have to maneuver our way to get in that space and bring something, and then we can bring stories out because we're being buried alive in there, and more of us are there. I've had students of mine that are back in school, you know, accepted into programs and then, you know, arrested on some stupid drug charge, sent back for 2 years when, you know, as a man getting his education. What's the point of that, right? And we've been told we're not allowed to testify for them because the college doesn't, I shouldn't say this even publicly, but the college doesn't like us to get up and do that. But, you know, when, isn't, are we talking about rehabilitation? If a man's back in school and he's feeding his family and he's got a dream to go do something and he's in a program, why are you putting him back in prison because he sold a little dope, right?
Right.
And, you know, hundreds and hundreds, so many of our people, as we know, are there. So, yeah, I think any black person, but especially artists, if we're not putting our time into at least finding some way to speak about that, to get people in space and just to bring something into that space and bring something out, I don't know how we can talk about consciousness if we're not talking about what's happening with that and what's happening on our streets with our youth, you know, putting guns into their hands, and then we have little babies running around shooting each other, and nobody cares, right? And nobody's talking to those youth about how to solve their problems and what they see in their communities. So somebody has to do it, and that's, I think, conscious black people have to be on the ground. You know, we can say, oh, what are you doing? Oh, I'm teaching university, but that's not the level where our real work is. You know, we have to be out there on the ground just relating to those kids, relating to our youth, relating to everybody. And if you can come with a real voice, it doesn't matter what your background is, people sense. If you have something to say to them and you're relating to them, that's when we're bonding as a people. And that kind of unity that we can create, I mean, we know that, that it's hard work, but we have to be on the ground every day doing it because our people are in crisis, especially here. And not a self-created crisis where they try to blame it on us, a crisis created by white supremacy because they know the strength that we have. So we always have to remember our strength and just keep rolling towards our unity as a people, our goals, what we know. So, yeah.
So I'll try to get my dancing thing on when I see you.
Go check the big perm. You're not going to, I don't know, now that you're telling me, I just don't think it will fit with your Nation of Islam, at least my brother. I don't think you can do the big perm.
No, I'm not a member of the Nation. I just, was influenced by, the non-dancing aspect, yeah. which I admit is a very non-African. African people dance, you know.
Well, and I guess in general, I mean, as we know, our people have creativity is all over the place. So even if you're not seeing it on Much Music or, you know, wherever, BET, whatever we're doing, you know, out on the stage and just to speak, you know, all the ways that our people are speaking and walking and, you know, how we drive, how tournament weekend this weekend. So, of course, there's parties all over the place. You know, Black Nova Scotia is out this weekend. It's a black basketball tournament that we have here. And so teams come in. So those are all the creative ways we live, and that's how we resist racism, right? It's how we show that we're still here. So,
well, you know, I'm sorry, I cut you off.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was saying that I was reading Amilcar Cabral from Guinea-Bissau, and he was talking about Islam in West Africa or in Guinea-Bissau, so-called Portuguese Guinea, how the when people accepted Islam, one of the provisos was that, you know, it's like we're not going to stop the singing and the dancing part, you know, like we, okay, you guys got us in terms of, they forced to accept Islam, but we'll accept it, but we're not going to stop our cultural stuff, you know, we're going to keep on... we want our music and our drums and so on and so forth. So that is a very strong thing about African people. But I wanted to say that...
Same thing in the church.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing in the church. I meant to say the shout when I said the shake before, but, you know, that the shout was like when they converted all the Africans and they were like, oh, man, they just won't stop dancing. So they had to let them do Christian dances instead.
Well, the whole thing about, if you see, there's a great film about Paul Robeson, and they show the African church in the South, and they show the people in West Africa, and the church service is an African service. You know, that's the only time Africans in America really were really allowed to be 100% African was in the church. As crazy as that sounds, but that's true.
I'm glad you mentioned Paul Robeson because he's, he's a very forgotten black hero. I hear his name coming back now, so I think people are reaching back and pulling him forward. But, you know, somebody was deliberately erased because of all he sacrificed. for black people. I wrote a poem about him once.
I'm a Paul Robeson. I'm a Paul Robeson fanatic.
Yeah, I know. And you know, a lot of people just don't know his name, and they set about erasing his name because of, if you've ever read his testimony in front of the House of Un-American Activities, I think that's the most brilliant. It gives me chills every time I read it.
You remember? I cut you off again. Go ahead.
When he was held in front of the House on American Activities, what's his face, of Senator McCarthy, and they're trying to take his passport. And you can find his testimony online, and it's just like everything he says is on point. And we're talking in like 1958, so really before civil rights has kicked off. And they're like, why don't you just leave America if you don't like it? And he says stuff like, my grandparents baked bread for Washington. You know, I'm descended from slaves. And he just schools them in history, and he's just not having any of it. And it's amazing. You get chills. Read it. But yeah, because of that, of course, they took his passport. They tried to stop him from performing. He used to drive to the border and sing to migrant workers. You know, somebody who made millions and gave every cent of it to support the struggle of the people. And
my favorite quote from him was when they at that same Un-American Activities situation, they asked him about your people. So I remember the quote was, he says, "My people, the American Negro, the West Indians, the Africans, oh, those are my people." It was like, so he had that.
Yeah,
whole,
and there's another great one when they go, "You haven't had it that hard. You know, you went to Rutgers. You're a lawyer. You're a movie star." And he says, "I do not consider the success of a few Negroes to make up for the millions of my people." So, you know, and I'm like, people today could stand to hear that from these hip hop artists and athletes. So yeah, no, I'm glad to. I mean, we're obviously vibing on the same ancestors because I'm a Malcolm person myself. I have a Malcolm X poem, Brother Malcolm. When I started writing poetry, I always knew I wanted a Malcolm X poem. I would look at the poster of Malcolm that I had on my Malcolm shrine, and finally was able to do something. Paul Robeson. I mean, and we know we stand in the palms of these ancestors. I mean, they speak to us. They guide our actions. And so we have to speak for them and try to carry that forward with us. So
we also need to talk about Paul Robeson's wife. Her autobiography is her biography has just come out, and his wife was a force of and in her. I mean, she was a force without him. She was Estella Robeson. I might be mispronouncing the name. I'm kind of deprived of not sleep, but Paul Robeson's wife is someone that we as African people, we need to check her out because she was just as important as Mr. Robeson.
And can I tell you a family secret?
Hmm?
My aunt was supposed to marry Paul Robeson way back in the day, but she was already married.
Oh, your aunt?
So turned out that she had married, I guess she had left, and they had a bit of the things, but he wanted to marry her, but didn't happen because she was already by the state married. But actually, the Jones family women have had strange connections with almost every revolutionary black man of the 20th century. One of my aunts is cited in Marcus Garvey's divorce papers.
Mm-hmm.
There's some strange connections. The Jones family women were part of a lot of revolutionary men's personal.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I guess I should mention the fact that, and I know you know this, that Malcolm X's mother, the first place when she left Grenada, as far as I know, the first place she came to was Halifax.
And I didn't know that.
Yeah, she came to Halifax, and her brothers were in Halifax. She came from a place called La Digue, which is in Grenada. That's where she was born, and she came to Halifax, Nova Scotia, and she had uncles that were there, and there were not enough black men in Halifax at that time. So they said, we don't want to see you hook up with a European man, so we're going to send you to Montreal. She moved to Montreal. That's where she met Earl Little, who was Malcolm's father, who came up from Reynolds, Georgia. So Malcolm X's parents, I don't know whether or not they were married in Montreal, but they actually met in Montreal, but Louise Langdon Norton, that's Malcolm X's mother, she lived until 1989, and she died in Kalamazoo, Michigan. And, that was the first place she settled outside of Grenada was Halifax, Nova Scotia. That would be a good, you guys, you young brilliant scholars can. I know you can find something out about that.
Go to. I'm gonna look that up.
There's a Jan Carew book. Jan Carew did a book called "Ghosts in Our Blood." Jan Carew just passed away. He was a Guyanese brother who used to live in Toronto and in Ghana, so on and so forth. He did. He talks about that.
Yeah. Also, the speech that Bob Marley based redemption songs on was a speech that Garvey made in Halifax.
I didn't know that.
Nova Scotia was the only place that actually really embraced Garveyism. When you go up, particularly in Cape Breton, mm-hmm. when you go up there, they still have Menlik Halls and Marcus Garvey Halls, and all the community centers are like that. And there's all kinds of like documents from time, like when they really embraced them up in the north, like Cape Breton. Really felt Garvey. There was a lot of Barbadians up there, but that was really the only place in Canada where people were real Garveyites. But the speech he made in Halifax, Marley's song is based on that. So there's all these, and of course, people used to come stay in Africville, like Joe Lewis stayed here. Different.
I never know that Joe Lewis came there.
Yeah, there's when people come to Flags, of course, they had to stay. In the Black Peace, which is Africville, so there's all kind of, like, the Africville descendants have all kinds of stories about who stayed with them, who was there, because it was segregated, right?
So, right.
But yeah, when you look at the history, there's all, as we know, like, our history just reaches out. There's all kinds of connections everywhere, so even though Nova Scotia seems small. And a lot of early Canadians, I started meeting people who had said that they, you know, because now Toronto is where kind of, you know, most people end up, but until the 60s, when Canada loosened immigration laws, the only significant Black communities are really in Nova Scotia. Those people in Vancouver, there's people all over, but, you know, they have this big established community in Nova Scotia, so a lot of people are like, oh yeah, I came there to go to nursing school. Or so for a long time, it actually was this real place that people came through in the way that people now go to Toronto. So when people start looking, they see these connections that they have to Black Nova Scotians and people that are Scotian in their family and that kind of Scotian spirit that carries out. Because wherever Scotians go, they bring that kind of Black Scotian spirit, right? Like, you can go to Calgary and find clumps of Scotians, Toronto, Montreal. You'll always find Scotian culture.
Yeah, strong. Yeah, in Toronto, when I first came here in the 60s, the Scotians ran Toronto, and a lot of the projects, the housing projects, some of the, you had to deal with the Scotians in terms, on the military level, they were control, used to, you know, stand up to the police and the other, the racist white Canadians. The Scotians were some of the people that were in the forefront of fighting that sort of situations.
And however much people might, you know, beef in the province, once Scotians leave the province, they're Scotians. So there's always that kind of family, team, crew unity that goes on. So, and also the railroad porters, of course, came across. So a lot of people working where the railroads are really active, spread out. So you have a lot of Scotians, like Vancouver, got a lot of people. So, yeah, there's been this reach, and it's such a historical population, right? Like 400 years of Black Scotians. So, yeah, I mean, if you're Black and in Canada and you haven't set foot in Africville or North Preston or Beachville or Shelburne or, you know, Hammond's Plains or anywhere, you know, you need to come here and you'll feel it in the ground. You'll feel it in the spring. Just getting to talk to the people out here, to hear the accents, to hear some of the ways that people talk and feel that African history. You know, we all need to do that. We all need to, and also go other places and make sure that we're always bringing our connections. Because, you know, we get caught up, but, yeah, we're part of, just the spiritual connection across the diaspora, you know. But yeah, it's really important for us to vibe and talk and get those histories and experiences out there and remember who we are as a people.
Well, we will definitely be calling you back. And it was a pleasure talking to you, and thank you for darkening me many issues,
and thank you, Bob.
I might get out there and try to shake a tail feather, learn how to do that dance.
All right. You take care of yourself, Keith.
All right. And we have been speaking with L. Jones, and this is Saturday Morning Live.
They got lions and elephants captive. They got panthers and jackals and giraffes. They take them all out of Africa and stare at them from behind glass. They go to the zoo with their families. They buy balloons and popcorns and candies. They point and laugh at the monkeys and never think that they might be unhappy. They got animals in the zoo taking Prozac until their eyes are a glassy blank. And if you're a black man, you know that it's the lion who understands. He knows how you feel when you wake up in fear of the whole world's gaze. You are a mask you can never let break up, and the world closes in like a cage. And some smoke crack on the corners, and some of the poor ones sniff gas, and the animals in the zoo chew their fur off and wait for this lifetime to pass. And the black men kill other black men like a fox bites his leg in a trap. When others are holding you hostage, it's always yourself you attack. And the giraffe just wants his freedom. That's why he's so sad. And they locked the panthers in prison. And we both have some rich man to thank. They said the animal's just like the black man. They said he's only safe in his cage. And so they took us from Africa and held us all hostage as slaves. And right when our slavery ended is right when the zoos began. They said, I guess we gotta own something if we can't get our black man back. They said, you better work like a dog boy. They said, you better obey our laws. They said, keep your eyes on the ground, boy, and they clip the lion's claws. They made that movie Free Willy. It made millions for them in the bank. And after the filming was over, they threw that whale back in a tank. They made trillions of dollars off slavery using the black man's tool. And after the slave trade was over, they didn't even give us our mule. It costs $1 million a year for a panda. That's the price of freedom these days. They say that the panda is valuable and they won't give us a fair wage. But if they really valued the panda, they'd know his freedom can never be priced. So what they're really paying for is the right to fuck with his life. They line up outside of the stadium. They pay boxers to batter their brains. Look what they done to Muhammad Ali, but they put Michael Vick in jail. They watch anything if it's degrading. They watch monkeys play with their poo. The monkeys keep them entertained. They make this whole world their zoo. They love us best when we're cartoons. They love rap stars and Winnie the Pooh. They got Flavor Flav on the TV, acting for them like a coon. And now they look in our faces and try to pretend that they've changed. And the zookeepers take their paycheck and say that the breeds are saved. They say the zoos are about conservation. They say that it's all in the past. They say a black man's elected president. They say racism's over at last. They say the lions would die without them. They call all the species endangered. They act like we all should be grateful they pay for the problems that they created. And now everyone's into the planet, and they tell us all to be green, but we all know the biggest danger this planet has ever seen.
Yeah. one I needed. The lights just a shining. I need to be just one in the number. As we stand again, here to need. Here believe in freedom.
Believe in freedom. And our rest.
Then struggling myself, don't mean a whole lot. I've come to realize that teaching others to stand on the line is the only way my struggle survives. Here believe in freedom.
Here believe in freedom.
I'm a woman who speaks in a voice that I'm loved to be heard. At times I can be quite difficult about a woman's word. We live in freedom.
We believe in freedom. It's not a rest.
But no one has seen her around. Now you know which way I'm headed. If my baby can't be found, I spoke to the river, and the river spoke back to me, and it said, you look so lonely, you look full of misery. And if you can't find your baby, come and make your home with me. Thank you. don't want to leave her, 'cause I know she's still alive. And someday I'm gonna find her, then I'll take her for a ride. Then we'll live our life forever in a home among the tide.
Wish I knew why I'm so in love with you. No one else in this world will do. Darling, please save your love for me. Run away if I were wise, I'd run away. But like a fool in love, I stay and pray you'll save your love for me. I can feel it even when you're not here, can't conceal it. I really love you, my dear. And though I know no good can come from loving you, I can't do a thing. Oh, I'm so in love with you. So darling, help me please. Mercy on a fool like me. I know I'm lost, but still I plead. Darling, please save your love for me. You may have fun in the crowd, but for crying out loud, darling, please save your love for me. Yeah.
is